In the wake of the deadly massacre in Las Vegas, how would Jacksonville handle a mass shooting? Our local Trauma One team explains what they do to prepare for mass casualty events. Good morning. And live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we're always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Get our podcast on iTunes or through the WJCT app. Just ahead, we welcome the UF Health Trauma Team and learn what they do to prepare for tragedy here on the First Coast. The only Level 1 trauma unit in the region speaks out. Get on the line now, 549-2937 to join us. Then later, October marks Domestic Violence Awareness Month as we speak with Hubbard House CEO Gail Payton. Also ahead, Jacksonville is hosting sister cities from around the world this week. Find out why they're here in town. All of that and more coming up this hour. But first this morning, we're learning new details about the tragedy in Las Vegas that took the lives of nearly 60 people and injured more than 500. Investigators are probing gunman Stephen Paddock's relationship with his longtime girlfriend, Marilou Danley, in hopes that she can shed some light on what drove him to open fire on a crowd at a country music concert from his casino hotel room Sunday night on the Vegas Strip. Authorities say prior to the shooting, Paddock had transferred close to $100,000 to someone in the Philippines, possibly his girlfriend. Eric Paddock says he now believes that his brother may have been trying to arrange for Danley to be abroad before he carried out his massacre. Meanwhile, the mass shooting spree strained the capabilities of first responders in Las Vegas to respond to such horrific carnage. It's the worst nightmare of trauma units around the country. Of course, they do their best to prepare for just such a calamity, and it is a sad reality in America that they have to do so. Jacksonville, actually, you might not know this, it used to be home to the worst single-day mass shooting in modern Florida history. That happened when James Edward Powell killed 9 people at a Bay Meadows GMAC loan office back in 1990 before taking his own life. It's a sad fact that mass shooting totals keep increasing year after year in America. Now, the trauma team at UF Health Jacksonville is always ready to leap into action to save lives, whether it's an accident on the freeway or multiple shootings. We begin the hour now with a closer look at how our local trauma team operates in any crisis situation. It is an amazing unit, and there are a lot of moving parts, and they really are eager to share with our listeners how they operate. We're pleased to welcome Chad McIntyre. He's manager of trauma flight services with Trauma One, the only level one trauma unit in the area, and it's based at UF Health Jacksonville. Hi, Chad.
Good morning, Melissa. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Also in studio, Dr. David Yourgaitis, a trauma acute care surgeon, and he also heads up a mass casualty group in the city. Dr. Yourgaitis, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
And what are your questions for the trauma team in Jacksonville? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. You can also weigh in on Facebook. We're already getting your comments there. Chad, let's begin with you. You're manager of trauma flight services with Trauma One. And let's explain, this is the only level one trauma unit in the area. What does that mean, the only level one unit?
So as a level one unit, we have services and capabilities and capacity that's greater than other resources in the city. We serve as a resource for not just education, research, but also critical care services and acute care surgery on a moment's notice. We have what I would say a very robust system that is built on managing multiple patients at all times of the day.
And in the event of a mass shooting or a pileup on the highway, that becomes tragically necessary.
Yes, ma'am. So, you know, one of the things that people forget is when you have a heart attack or you have a stroke, you're going to get one patient at a time. When you have a car accident on I-95 like we're facing today down in St. Augustine, or you have a mass shooting, you're going to get several patients. You're going to get them all at the same time. And in an event like this, and in most tragedies, we find that the first notification you're going to get is when the patient shows up at the back door. It's not going to be the radio report from the fire. It's not going to be the news. It's going to be a patient that actually shows up at the back door, and they're going to be multiple of those.
Okay. Dr. Yourgaitis, you're a trauma acute care surgeon. You also head up a mass casualty group in Jacksonville. just try to put yourself in the place of the responders in Las Vegas. It's almost unbearable to imagine what that situation was like when Paddock opened fire on that crowd. 58 people dead and 500 people taken to the hospital. I can't even imagine what it was like.
You can try to prepare every day for incidents like this, as we see, and as you showed, there's increasing amounts of these each year as we go by. And I think that really is an impetus for the community, the local law enforcement, fire, EMS, trauma centers, and other healthcare facilities to really prepare for these events as a unit.
And let me ask you about that. Trauma One is training EMS providers to operate in hot zones when under fire, the only place in the area that's doing something like this. Is that right?
Yes. I'm the medical director of the tactical training at Trauma One. We've outreached and trained several counties in the area, both law enforcement and EMS. When I started in EMS, when I started in healthcare, I started in EMS, and we used to talk about scene safe, how many victims, and I need more help anytime you approach a scene. We've now changed that to take the provider into a zone that may not be as secure as previously. As we know from previous incidents, specifically Sandy Hook, if we had providers that could enter there and provide bleeding control, the death toll would have been less.
It's 549-2937 to join us. And when you say Sandy Hook, you're referring to the tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut, when the shooter there, Mark Lanza, opened fire on school children and killed a number of little kids. You're talking about a practice called Stop the Bleed that was developed after Sandy Hook. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. The leading cause of pre-hospital death in trauma victims is hemorrhage. And we really have to, that's bleeding, uncontrolled bleeding. And we have to work with the community, not only the professionals, EMS, but the lay public, to turn them into immediate responders. And we know that tourniquets save lives. Out of Sandy Hook, such a tragedy occurred. But what grew out of that is we've studied it. We've also studied, you know, the Pulse nightclub. I spend a lot of time doing such analyses. And we know that immediate response is necessary, and that is the person standing next to you. You may save your life or someone else's life. And that's where the bleeding control and hemorrhage control and tourniquets came about. So far, I've treated 6 patients in Jacksonville that were victims of violence that had a tourniquet in place that saved their life, placed by EMS, police, or lay public.
Chad McIntyre, Trauma One, I know, often is dispatched with incredible speed to treat stroke victims. And yes, the phrasing there is time is brain. You know, the sooner you can get to a stroke victim, the quicker you can save their life. It sounds as though speed is the watchword in responding to these events where gun violence is the reason that you're sent out, because we're a violent society and gun violence is tragically common. And you have to be trained to get out there quickly, and you have to be trained to respond with speed to save lives in this manner too.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things that, as Dr. Yokaitis said, and, you know, to touch on, follow up on what you just said, Melissa, is that we are seeing more penetrating trauma than what we have in years past, where most of the time our trauma was related to falls and motor vehicle crashes, and those still remain very high, but the number of penetrating traumas continues to rise. And as that happens, we have to train our EMS people how to operate in not necessarily 100% controlled scenes. We have to have the public be immediate responders, because the life they save could be their family members or their own. And we have to be able to think about that these people will bleed to death in less than 3 to 5 minutes if it's an arterial bleed. So we have to control that bleeding. We have to get people there quickly and evacuate those patients as quickly as possible.
Lots of calls for the Trauma One team as we talk about the mass shooting in Las Vegas and how trauma teams around the country, including our Level 1 Trauma One health professionals at UF Health Jacksonville, are trained to respond to these horrific events that we see all too frequently in this country. What are your questions for these health professionals? It's 549-2937 to join the show right now. Lena is in San Marco. Hey, Lena, good morning to you. Lena, good morning.
Yes, good morning. My husband and I are both retired physicians. We're not surgeons, but we were wondering if there is some use for us and who we would call and contact to be able to help in situations like this.
Sure. Thanks for that question.
So, Lena, there's always a place for our medical professionals to respond. First of all, the city has a great program called Community Emergency Response Team. It's called CERT. Those are citizens that have some medical background that can respond in times of disaster to help their fellow citizens. More importantly, we ask that you take a Stop the Bleed course. We offer those courses free all over the city. You can reach out to the Trauma One office, and we'll make sure that Melissa has all that on her website to follow up. But we would urge you to take that class and learn. We think everybody should know how to stop the bleed, control hemorrhage, and also be part of their community because that's how we're going to save lives.
549-2937. Mylon in Ponte Vedra Beach this morning. Good morning.
Yes, hello. I just wonder why, you know, the conversation isn't about getting to the root cause of the problem and restricting, you know, firearms and ammunition, you know. And I'm shocked that, you know, our politician, you know, I think it was Ryan, Senator Ryan, you know, came out and said, you know, this is not their priority. You know, how many more massacres is it going to take, you know, to change the mindset and the culture here? It's terrible, you know. I don't know what the rest of the world, you know, you know, is this the Wild West? You know, what kind of a culture are we living in here?
Thanks, Mylon. You know, yesterday we welcomed a former member of Congress to this program, Jason Altmaier, and we talked about the politics of addressing gun violence in this country. And certainly, for Democrats anyway, running for office, this will be a litmus test, not for Republicans who are opposed to further restrictions on gun ownership. That said, Chad McIntyre, increasingly among health professionals, particularly those that work in the nation's emergency rooms, I've seen, particularly in recent years, as we see more and more of these mass shootings, doctors such as yourself talking about gun violence as a public health issue and working to reframe this as a public health problem. What about that?
So, you know, we at UF Health and then Trauma One, we try to stay on the outskirts of the politics of, but what we can't avoid is the fact that this is an epidemic in our country, that we cannot continue to wring our hands and say prayers for each time that we don't address the issue. At some point, we're going to have to look at the fact that when penetrating trauma begins to rise to the point that it's more than motor vehicle crashes, it's matching the number of people that are dying from overdoses, which we all have said that these are massive public health emergencies, that we have got to act on that. So while I will avoid, obviously, from the healthcare side to get into the politics of my view of what I believe is responsible gun ownership and that what the public believes, is that in the meantime, we have to have a conversation about the damage that's being done to our communities and the damage that's being done from the gun violence and how we address those.
Yeah, the American Medical Association on Monday renewed its call for background checks and waiting periods for gun ownership. They adopted that policy after the mass shootings at the Pulse nightclub last year. Dr. Yourgaitis.
As a member of the American College of Surgeons, as a trauma surgeon, the American College of Surgeons has a position statement on firearm injuries. And one thing I think that's highlighted is, as a scientist and an evidence-based practitioner, I have no evidence because there's a ban on funding firearm research.
That's right. Congress hasn't funded any study of this because of the politics around this
Correct.
Issue.
And I'd love to provide the science behind the care and to help our communities with evidence-based guidelines. Also, you know, trauma is the number one cause of death of young people in the United States, but yet it's totally unfunded and underfunded, and we really need to push so we can gather the evidence to provide the best care possible to prevent the most lives lost.
And not only does the, what was the group, the College of Surgeons?
American College of Surgeons.
The American College of Physicians has labeled gun violence a public health issue for more than 20 years, and they have specifically called for legislation that would ban the sale and ownership of automatic and semi-automatic weapons. Semi-automatic weapon, I believe, was the type of weapon...
Semi-automatic that was converted.
That was converted. Right. That was what was used in Vegas. Okay, 549-2937. Joey, driving along I-95 right now. Hello, Joey.
Hi, how you doing?
Go ahead, Joey.
Great. I got a question. I used to be a veteran in the United States Air Force, and one specific thing that we were trained on was the treatment of sucking chest wound, where you take a round in the lung, and the air is sucked into the lung. What's the immediate response for something like that? And I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Joey, thank you for your service for our country. A chest wound, we talked about bleeding control, but we didn't talk about other life-threatening injuries, and one of them is thoracic injuries. As we know, the UF law student had a chest injury. And we talk about sucking chest wounds. It's just placing your hand or an occlusive dressing, something that's airtight, over the wound and letting it up, your hand or the dressing occasionally to allow, we call it burping, to allow air to escape. So just cover the wound and hold pressure, allow it to air to escape every so often.
549-2937 as we speak with the top flight medical professionals of Jacksonville's Trauma One. Bob is in Grove Park right now. Hey, Bob. Good morning.
Hi, Melissa. Good morning. Thanks. I just have a related comment that I've really asked the media and social media and everyone else to stop using the man's name. You know, I think it's people who are crazy like that, they do this for their fame or their infamy. And if we stop, you know, recognizing that, the next nut job that's sitting out there for thinking he's going to get his fame might not think so much about it.
Well, you know, so, Bob, you know, I unfortunately have taken the onus on myself for the last decade to really research all of our mass shootings and how we respond, the actions and the evidence behind each one. And while I agree that in most cases they would say we don't want to promote the killer, I think that for those of us that are academics, we want to gather as much information. And sometimes by releasing that name, someone will, and for example, the owner of the gun shop says, wait a minute, I know that person. So I think that I think that's a two-sided coin. And I, while I agree with you of the promotion of not having that happen, and but I also understand that when they release the name by the media, someone says, I know that person, I heard this, and that's why they're trying to gather this information.
And we appreciate everyone's calls this morning. Certainly emotions are raw on this issue, and it's, I hate having to constantly discuss this over and over and over. Gentlemen, I so appreciate you coming in and sharing this information, because it's such a wonderful resource that we have in downtown Jacksonville, by the way, Trauma One. Okay, let's go to Sarah in St. Augustine. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Sarah.
I just had two. One was just a comment about the semi-automatic weapons, just kind of piggybacking. I'm very pro Second Amendment and the right to bear arms, but with those semi-automatic weapons, there's just no point to that. They're only designed for mass killings, and we need to get those off the streets. Beyond that, though, I also had a question for your guest, and I was wondering if you were looking to put any of those Stop the Bleed programs in our local schools, in our middle schools, our high schools, even our colleges.
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, Sarah, you know, I agree with you on the Second Amendment, and that's a hot topic that will always remain. But, you know, 90% of the public is in the same view, in the same lane as you, of saying that responsible gun ownership and doing the right thing. So I applaud you for making that statement. As far as the Stop the Bleed courses, so we offer a lot of those courses here locally. We are getting ready to go. We've worked with the Catholic Archdiocese of Northeast Florida. We're going to be training all of their people and their students. Getting into the public schools is a little difficult, but if you want my opinion, I think every seventh grader should learn CPR and should learn how to stop the bleed, because those skills will stay with them for life.
Yeah, okay. And here are a few comments for you guys on Twitter and Facebook. Mark on our Facebook page, how often do they train for an event like this? When was the last time they held a training? Here's a tweet for you coming in from Lisa. In the mid-90s in Gainesville, I was a victim, in quotes, in a fake plane crash so the whole system could practice, test, and improve. Do they do things like that in Jacksonville for a shooting incident?
So our most recent one was a chemical biological event. The light on the mass shooting today, but we have to prepare for all types of events. So we rotate what type of event we do. I do a lot of outreach with the community with involving Trauma One flight crews and local EMS agencies on this. And we offer that on outside agencies about once a quarter. And then inside the hospital, we get challenged every day with mass casualties. You know, a couple weeks ago, I was faced with 15 victims, mostly pediatric, from an I-95 accident. And every day is a test of the system, and we practice every day. And then we provide feedback for each other of what we did right, how can we improve, and we even engage the patients. How did this go for you? And I think that's really important.
So, Melissa, one of the things I was going to bring up is when you brought it up is it's kind of a tie-in is that just last Thursday we had all the regional trauma surgeons and trauma agencies at UF Health for a regional meeting. And Dr. John Fields, who happens to be a very close friend of mine, who is also the chair of the Department of Surgery at University Medical Center in Nevada, was our keynote speaker.
Jeff is in Mandarin. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, how are you, Melissa?
Okay, thanks.
Good. Hey, I have a quick question. I'm interested in becoming an EMT and was wondering about training processes for it. I know FSCJ has a program, and I know there are commercial schools for it. Which is it? Could I get some feedback on which one's a better option?
Sure. Go, yeah.
So I would never give a promotional plug to any of the programs. I think Camden College has a very good program. I know most of their instructors, a couple of their staff are also my staff. The FSCJ has a great program. So there are many good schools. I would look at what is best within your budget, what has the best clinical experience. I wish you well in your career as an EMT. I'm currently coming out of up on 25 years myself in pre-hospital care, and it's been very rewarding. It's also a very hard job, so I wish you well. And if there's anything we can do to help you at Trauma One, we'll make sure to have our email address to Melissa and her staff to have on the website.
Jeff, I'm going to put you on hold so that you can contact the team here directly. Is that all right?
Okay, what was that first school that you mentioned?
Camden. It's Camden College. It's over on Salisbury, and then FSCJ up on the north side.
Awesome.
I'm going to put you on hold, Jeff, and we'll talk to you offline, okay? Okay. And gentlemen, thanks so much for your public service to this region, and thanks for being on the show today.
Well, Melissa, I really appreciate you taking time to address this issue and allowing us to really get the community engaged as immediate responders. The life you save may be your husband, your child, or it may be your own, and that's how we really are going to make a difference.
Thank you again, Melissa. And if I can just make a plug for bleedingcontrol.org. That's where you can go and learn about more information about hemorrhage control and how to respond to an incident.
Such vital information, gentlemen. Thanks so much. Chad McIntyre, he's manager of trauma flight services with Trauma One, UF Health Jackson. Dr. David Yorgaitis, a trauma acute care surgeon. He also heads up a mass casualty group in Jacksonville. And much more still ahead. Later, a look at the five-year anniversary of City Year Jacksonville. But up next, marking Domestic Violence Awareness Month in Duval County. Back in a moment.
WJCT's Jaguar Season Parking is still available. Be part of the coolest tailgating downtown. Includes paved space, indoor bathroom access. Contact Holly Manuel at 358-6311 or log on to wjct.org/parking. Reserve your space today. Hey, Car Talk fans, if you're wondering why Click and Clack aren't here, NPR is no longer distributing the Best of Car Talk. The good news is you can continue to listen to the podcasts of the program at cartalk.com. We hope you enjoy WJCT's new weekend schedule. For more information about the new programs, visit wjct.org/weekends.
This week on Jazz Night in America, Our Point of View, a leaderless supergroup of Blue Note artists.
Our Point of View is our story, our influence, our life, and our music.
Robert Glasper, Derek Hodge, Kendrick Scott, Lionel Luweke, Ambrose Akinmusiri, and Marcus Strickland. Discover Our Point of View this week on Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, this is Keith Marks. Join me Thursday nights at 11 p.m. starting October 12th for Avant Radio. Curious music for curious minds. Only on 89.9 FM. Your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, law enforcement officials joined advocates Tuesday along with survivors at a kickoff event to mark the start of Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Some survivors also sounded words of warning at the release of the 2016 Domestic Violence Fatality Report. 14 of last year's 17 cases of domestic homicide in this area involved male suspects, and 71% of the victims were women. That's the third straight year of higher male suspects and female victims. And there's a lot more to discuss in the data. Hubbard House CEO Gail Payton joins us now with more. Gail, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And October is always Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and you kicked it off with Sheriff Mike Williams and other folks. There's a lot to look at in the report you released. What can you share with us?
Well, there is a lot to look at, and we're looking at a 20-year high in domestic violence homicides, and that's frightening. We're talking about, as far as intimate partner violence, 100% increase from last year.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what do you think's driving that?
We don't know exactly what's driving that, but we do know some factors that contribute to deaths. And what we found out, not only from the study last year, but from looking at it over a 20-year history, is that the people that are dying are the ones who are not seeking help. They aren't calling the police. They aren't advocating or looking for their local domestic violence center. And those are the people that are dying that aren't getting any type of intervention. So it's really, really important that not only during Domestic Violence Awareness Month, mm-hmm. but throughout the year, that we continue to let people know that services are available, continue to let them know that JSO is here to help them. We have great partners in JSO. They really do a fabulous job. And when JSO gets involved, when Hubbard House gets involved, or the other sister shelters, people's lives are saved. And this is what the data is really saying.
Hubbard House in Duval County, Quigley House in Clay County, and Hubbard House is just an amazing place, an amazing resource for women or men to go to seek shelter and get help.
Right. We've been around for over 40 years, and we're here because of the community. We can't do this without the community support, and we have an emergency shelter that people can come who are in the most danger to decide what they want to do for the rest of their life. But we also have an outreach program. If somebody is thinking, I don't know if I should come into shelter, but I really need to talk to somebody, we have an outreach center. Or call our hotline. It's a free call. It's anonymous. You can begin to learn about what's going on in your relationship. What are some things that you can do to stay safe? And if you're thinking of leaving, how to do it in the safest manner possible.
And there are so many misconceptions about domestic violence and abuse. I wish I had a nickel for every time I've heard someone say, well, why doesn't she just leave? And often the dynamics are very complicated. It's not as easy as people might realize for a woman to just walk out of a relationship that's abusive.
Very much so. And we do hear that. And what that assumes is that when a person leaves a relationship, that the abuse stops. But that becomes when it may be more violent.
And the most dangerous.
Exactly. And so when a person does plan on leaving, they need to do it in a safe manner. But there are a lot of barriers that victims experience from leaving. One of them is economic. If a person is faced with, I'm going to live on the street with my children or I'm going to stay in this home, oftentimes moms will choose to stay in the home and do what they can do to keep their children safe,
right,
while figuring something out for the future.
One of the most harrowing stories I ever heard was a woman living in a terrible, violent situation. And one form of abuse, of course, is financial abuse. A woman has no access to any money. And this woman, over a period of years, hid every spare dollar bill she could inside tampon tubes. Mm. Because she knew that was the one place her husband wouldn't look.
Right. How absolutely smart of her.
And after many years, she finally had enough cash to leave.
Wow.
That's how she got away.
And that shows you that.
So that gives people a sense of how hard it can be for some people to get
and
away.
And how they have to plan.
They have to plan, right. Mm-hmm. And so as CEO of Hubbard House, you've heard a lot of these stories, I'm sure.
Absolutely. We hear it every day, and we hear about the amazing steps that victims go through to keep themselves alive and their kids alive until they can get free. And that's what we're here for when we're on the phone, to help them walk through what are some options they might have. We're not here to tell people what to do. We're here to help them explore their options and to be a support to them.
And it's hubbardhouse.org. Anyone can go there, and anyone can call the hotline. What's the hotline number?
It's 1-800-500-1119. That is the Florida line, and it will link you to the closest domestic violence center, whatever county you're in.
You also have a breakfast coming up tomorrow, the 23rd annual Barbara Ann Campbell Memorial Breakfast, and you're going to share some really powerful stories and talk about all of these issues.
Yes, the breakfast is actually a week from tomorrow.
Oh, sorry, that's a week from tomorrow. Pardon me.
That's all right. On the 12th, and the venue's been changed from the Hyatt to the Prime Osborne because of flooding, so we're going to be at the Prime Osborne. And what we like about this event is not only is it a fundraising event, but it's an awareness-raising event. And we have speakers that we've helped over the years who come to tell their story, because there's nobody who can tell it better than somebody that has lived through it and who can stand in front of 500, 600 people and say, this is my reality and this is how I got free. Mm-hmm. It's a powerful breakfast to attend. You can go to hubbardhouse.org to purchase a ticket. We really encourage everybody to come out, bring a friend, because your life will be changed and you'll get information to change somebody else's life as well.
It's hubbardhouse.org, hubbardhouse.org. Go to the website. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Download the 2016 Domestic Violence Fatality Report. As Gail said, domestic homicides have spiked in this area, which is alarming. And learn more about this issue. She's CEO Gail Payton, and I first got to know Gail in Leadership Jacksonville, and I was excited to see you got promoted. So congrats on your promotion at Hubbard House.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Back in a moment.
One minute after 5 in the morning.
The president of the World Bank is calling.
One minute after noon.
New York City authorities are investigating a second deadly crane collapse.
One minute after 5 in the evening.
The commander of the Joint African Union has said.
One minute after 11 at night.
At least one tornado is reported to have touched down today.
What's happening? What's known? What's next? One minute after the hour, every day, from NPR News.
At Marketplace Money, we aim to improve your financial life and sometimes save lives.
No one wants to have a laptop explode on them after they spent a couple thousand dollars on one.
Personal finance you can really use.
Saturday afternoons at 4 on 89.9 WJCT.
November 11th of each year is the day that we ensure veterans know that we deeply appreciate the sacrifices they have made in their lives to keep our country free. Help WJCT honor our veterans during the month of November by submitting a name that we may add to our on-air thank you announcements. Go to wjct.org/veterans.
Welcome back. Well, the Jacksonville Sister Cities Association is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. And this week, they're commemorating their golden anniversary with a series of events and welcoming international visitors from around the world. Now, one of our sister cities is actually San Juan, Puerto Rico. San Juan, of course, is still on its back, struggling to recover from the devastation of Hurricane Maria. Here with more about that and the Sister City celebration, we welcome Jacksonville Sister Cities Association President, Dr. Tonjilla Manley. Dr. Manley, good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
And so people coming in from eight sister cities to Duval, including San Juan. Did they send someone in spite of the hurricane?
Actually, no. San Juan was not able to send a representative, and we understand that. And we are actually trying to support relief efforts to make sure that they get the support they need.
What are we sending to San Juan?
Well, we have a collection at the Stanton Prep where we're collecting food and baby items, clothing, blankets, towels, whatever you can support,
right.
Whatever you can send.
Yeah, and my daughter's school, they're doing the same. I think several schools are doing similar efforts, which is great.
Yes, yes, yes. And also, we're supporting the port's efforts and the city's efforts. So we're really trying to make sure that we support our sister city.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about the Sister Cities Association. How did this all begin 50 years ago? What's the idea behind this?
Well, the Sister Cities Association was established when President Eisenhower established the Sister Cities International as an opportunity for us to pause for peace, develop sister relationships with cities, not federal government, but with cities.
Okay.
And Jacksonville Sister Cities established in 50 years ago, and we started with our partnership with Bahía Blanca, Argentina.
That was our first sister city?
That was our first sister city.
Why Argentina?
I don't know.
That's so random.
Well, you know, probably because of that wonderful culture.
Don't cry for me, Argentina.
There you go. So we're excited.
Were we early into Eva Perón or something?
I don't know, but it's a wonderful it's a wonderful partnership. We do a lot of student exchanges with them annually. We are hosting the tango dancers this week, and that I think that's something we've done over the years. So we are excited about that sister city as well as the others, and we have three that are coming today: Bahía Blanca, Changwon City, South Korea, and Murmansk, Russia.
Russia?
Yes.
Hey now.
Yes.
Are there going to be any uncomfortable questions about Vladimir Putin at this
event? No.
You're steering clear of all that?
We focus
There will be
on
no questions
cities.
About Bob Mueller and Russian bots on Facebook? None of that?
No, we focus strictly on our relationship with our cities, and it's a very comfortable, loving, and familiar city relationship.
So they get to experience Jacksonville, and then do we send a delegation to their city at a certain point too?
We do. We send delegations around to our sister cities. We are going to, one delegation is going to South Africa in November. Changwon City will probably visit in March of 2018, China. And we go around, and we enjoy our relationships. As you know about the immersion program with Nantes, France, we do that annually.
Right. People get to go to Nantes in France and really experience the culture, and they have to speak the language.
Yes.
They don't speak any English the whole time they're there. They really do immerse themselves. How are these exchanges funded?
The participants fund their own exchange, their own airfare. Generally, when we host groups here as well as when we go there, they cover our accommodation and our food. So when we host the groups here this week, we're providing a lot of meals, transport. We want them to know that they're our guests here.
This is really an amazing way to pull the world a little closer together,
mm-hmm.
isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it is. It is. And we enjoy promoting that through our efforts. For example, you know about our peace concert. We do an annual peace concert, and we just want to promote peace, peace through partnership, peace through our sister relationships with cities.
Okay, so what else? So what all is happening this week, and how can the public kind of be part of this?
Okay, well, the first thing is we're going to take them to Art Walk tonight.
Oh, very nice.
Yes, 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 and enjoy the Oktoberfest, and we're going to just show them the best of Jacksonville. They'll have an event at City Hall, Jack's Chamber, the port, the zoo. We're going to the beach. We're just going to show them the best of Jacksonville. And then the public can participate through our reception on Thursday evening. We're having that at the library, the main library in downtown. And the public can purchase tickets at jsea.org and be a part of that.
Okay, it's jsea.org.
J-S-C-A.
Oh, pardon me, jsca.org. There will be representatives from Argentina, South Korea, and Russia.
That's right, that's right.
That'll be part of this whole delegation.
And the fun thing is the tango dancers will perform on Thursday night.
At the library.
At the library.
So let me get this straight. Tonight you're going to have Argentinians, South Koreans, and Russians checking out the Stein holding contest at Oktoberfest. Is this right?
I believe they'll enjoy it.
And then tomorrow night, you're going to have a bunch of tango dancers at the library.
That's
Am I getting
right.
all this right?
You've got that right.
So
yes.
We're going to have this incredible mishmash of cultures all around Hemming Park
this week
in Jacksonville.
Yes. And we're planning to have the tango dancers do just a brief preview tonight at the library.
Very cool.
Yes, yes.
Well, it's the 50th anniversary of Jacksonville Sister Cities Association, so you need to be out and about in the urban core tonight and tomorrow night to check it out. Go to jsca.org for more. Very interesting. And thanks for the update, Dr. Tanjilla Manley. She's president of the JSCA. Have fun.
Thank you so much. We're going to enjoy it.
We'll be right back.
Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A. I grew up in West Palm Beach, just down I-95 from Jacksonville, and it always amazed me how many different kinds of people that highway connects. Now I get to connect with people from all walks of life here on WJCT, debating tough topics with courage, clarity, and compassion. Join us for 1A, weekday mornings at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Looking for an echo.
We are always looking for that perfect echo in the doo-wop revivals, Sunday at 8 and Monday at 9. We play the best in doo-wop, a cappella, and a little mix of soul.
WJCT and the Florida Theater present Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood live in King for a Day, Sunday, November 26th at 2 p.m. in the beautiful Florida Theater. Featuring dance numbers, new songs, surprise guests, and more. Go to WJCT.org/events for more information.
For everyone discovering life after 50, WJCT proudly presents Next Avenue, a website where grown-ups keep growing. Visit us at WJCT.org/nextavenue. It's today's modern guide for adulthood, part two.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, City Year Jacksonville is entering its fifth anniversary in the Duval County Public Schools this fall. City Year started out as a very small group of AmeriCorps members, but it's grown over the years to placing young professionals in urban classrooms across the country. And what they do is bridge the gap in high poverty communities between the support that the kids actually need and what the schools are designed and resourced to provide. The goal everywhere? It's to increase graduation rates. There's an important application deadline coming up to be part of City Year. Here with more about that, we welcome Zach Draper, Regional Admissions Manager, and Team Leader Quentin Griffin. Hey, guys. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Zach, let's start with you. City Year is celebrating 5 years in Duval this fall. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, we're really excited to be a part of the First Coast community and with Duval County Schools.
How did City Year get started? As I said, it started pretty small, didn't it?
Yeah. So it started in 1988 in Boston with about 50 people. And it started just as a pilot program. It was
AmeriCorps initially, right?
Yeah. We are an AmeriCorps program. So we started a couple years before AmeriCorps, but have worked really closely with them over the years. And they've helped us expand to 29 cities today.
And Quentin, you're a team leader. You're at Ed White.
Yes, ma'am.
In your second year.
Yes, ma'am.
And so there are thousands of young adults like you in schools. They dedicate a couple of years, maybe more, to City Year. What's your experience been like so far?
It's been amazing. My first year was like ridiculously amazing for me, to be honest. I learned so much about myself and about the kids and about my community as well, enough so to where I want to come back and serve a second year. And especially since I went to the school I served at, it made a bigger impact in my life.
And to be clear, you're not a teacher, but you're working alongside the teachers.
Yes, ma'am. We work in the classrooms, and we're kind of like mentors and role models and tutors to the kids in the classroom.
So what's a typical day like for you?
Typical day, I get to school bright and early before the kids arrive. We usually greet the kids in the morning as they come in so we can greet them with some warmth and some energy so they have a good start for their day. I go to class with them all, so I'm alongside of them during instruction. And at the end of the day, we have a tutoring program. And we tutor kids from 2 to 5 on a daily.
Yeah. So you're there to provide extra support to the teachers and to the kids, really, it sounds like.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. And you're paid some money, but you're not being paid a professional salary. So this is something that young adults do out of college for a few years. And this is an amazing form of public service.
Yes, ma'am, it is. It really is. Like you said, we don't get paid the most money, but the experience that you get from it is value. It's like you just can't replace it with money. So,
and Zach, the goal of City Year is to increase graduation rates. What's the track record for City Year?
We work with students third through ninth grade. We work with them in attendance behavior coursework. The goal is to help them graduate high school. So focus on math and English, I think schools that partner with City Year, the students are definitely more likely to grow. I think it's 3.5 times more likely in math if they partner with City Year.
Mm-hmm. And there's an application deadline coming up.
Yeah. So we are currently hiring core members to start in November and January for mid-year positions. And that application is live now at cityyear.org. And then for our full-year positions starting in July, that application is also at cityyear.org.
What kind of young adult is attracted to this type of gig, I guess you'd call it?
Yeah. So we look for a very diverse group. We take 18 to 25-year-olds from all different backgrounds. We're looking for people with experience working with students and youth, but really anybody that wants to give back, spend a year really growing and learning about themselves while supporting the community.
How did you get started with it?
My sister actually served with City Year 6 years before me, and I served in Columbia, South Carolina a few years ago. And I just, I wanted to give back. I wanted to work with students and help them out, and I really found a home here.
Okay, and Quentin, you're in your second year at Ed White.
Yes, ma'am.
And after you finish the year up, what do you think you're going to do?
I'm actually looking into some mentoring opportunities in Jacksonville now. So I've been partnering up with a few people. So.
Where are you from, Jacksonville?
Yes, I am from Jacksonville.
So you want to stay in Jacksonville?
I want to stay in Jacksonville. I love this community. So.
What's it like for the kids when they see, because the City Year core members, they wear these bright red jackets, right?
Yes,
in the classroom. Mm-hmm. You see them in the halls in the bright red fleece jackets. What's it like for the kids to see City Year in the halls at school? What are your interactions with them like?
So the kids who are familiar with it, they already know when they see the red jackets, they come to us and they like ask us for help all the time. The kids who aren't as familiar with City Year, we have to like tell them like we wear the red jacket. It's like a symbol of like idealism and brightness. And whenever we engage with the students, it's always like that positive interaction that we have.
And your goal is to just lift the students up.
Yes, ma'am. Any way we can, academically and on social emotional level too.
And in particular, young male students need male role models in high poverty schools. How important is that for you to provide that for And what grades are you particular? Are you working with certain grade levels there?
Oh, well, at White.
At Ed White?
I work with 9th and 10th.
9th and 10th.
Yes, ma'am.
That's a critical time in a young man's life.
Yes, ma'am. I think that the students that I've worked with who have the same demographic as me respond to me especially well. And I can tell them, I can connect with them on a more personal level, too. So.
What are some of the most common issues you find they're dealing with?
Just home issues. Sometimes it's academics, like they have a little confidence in class. And those are things that we're all there for. So.
Yeah. Well, this is something that I hope people out there listening, you know, that they respond to. Is it a complicated application process, Zach?
No. The application is, it's about 2 short answer questions. And once you submit your application, if you apply to Jacksonville, you'll be hearing from me personally. We have a phone interview, and I would work with you pretty closely to interview you and get you set up.
Now, you're also celebrating a year of gratitude as well. Can you tell me a little bit about that really quickly?
Yeah. So we're, very grateful for the AmeriCorps members that serve with us, that commit to spending a year of their lives serving the Jacksonville community. And we're really grateful for all of our partners with Duval County Schools. They've partnered with us for the past 5 years. And, with all of our team sponsors and donors, they've really supported our work here.
Okay, so the application deadline for City Year is coming up October 27th. If you're a young adult aged 18 to 25 and you're interested in becoming a Corps member, go to cityyear.org and apply. Zach will be your boss. He seems nice, so I'm sure you'll like him. Zach Draper and Quentin Griffin, both with City Year of Jacksonville. Guys, thanks for joining us. Again, that website is cityyear.org. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
And that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app or get our podcast on iTunes. Next on 1A, what happens to people after they survive a mass shooting, wounded but alive? That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.